Well, if you'll go ahead and take your Bibles and turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. We're going to be in chapters 18 and 19 tonight. We're going to kind of be hitting and popping in on the text and then pulling out from it and popping back in on it. But I'm really glad that we're going to be together to study this particular subject. It's a fascinating story to me. He's a great man, this Elijah, but in some ways, he demonstrates some of the foibles and the failures that characterize our own lives. And the story, as it begins for us tonight, appears in my mind to be much like the opening of a movie. There's a man, and he is running, and we don't know what he's running from, but he is panting, and he is weak, and he is finally staggering up to a juniper tree where he collapses underneath it, and his eyes are furtively glancing about all the time, looking for some danger that is impending for him. And we don't know what that is. And the story begins with that kind of suspense. He is weary. He is shaking with fear. He is in a very desolate place. And he is only 24 hours away from his greatest accomplishment in life. That's what makes chapters 18 and 19 so fascinating to me. Because in chapter 18, Elijah experiences the pinnacle in his life. I mean, there cannot be a greater accomplishment for this man than what happens in chapter 18. It's a story that children are told. Not all the details, because it's a brutal story for children. But it's a fascinating accomplishment by a man of God. So, let's start with a pinnacle. Let's see where Elijah went. What were the heights to which he rose? What was his greatest success? It is here in 1 Kings chapter 18. Now, you go back, you only have to go back one chapter to see the very beginning of Elijah. In chapter 17, Elijah appears on the scene like some kind of atom bomb. I mean, he just explodes into the text. We don't know anything about him prior to this. We've never seen him. We haven't watched him grow up like we have some of the prophets. We've not seen him develop himself. We don't know about his calling from God. And that scene in chapter 17 is a fascinating scene. He enters into the court of one of the most wicked, dangerous kings in all of Israel's history. And this Elijah comes on like gangbusters. I mean, he marches into this throne room. How he got permission to go there before Ahab, we just have no idea. Did he force his way in? Did Ahab receive some message? There's a prophet of God who has a message for you. Elijah walks into the throne room, walks up to Ahab, and he utters these words to him. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand. That's one of Elijah's favorite phrases. Before whom I stand. That very phrase is just pregnant with concepts. Wait a minute, Elijah. You mean you don't bow in the presence of God? You stand in His presence? And not just in His presence, but you stand in front of Him? You stand before God? And it's not just before whom I stood once or twice. The verb here is before whom I continually stand. I want to tell you, there are not very many people in all the scriptures who react in the presence of God like Elijah does. Not John. In the book of Revelation, when John just sees one of his angels, not even God himself, just one of the angels, he falls down at his feet as if he's dead. In Revelation, over and over and over again, you've got John being told by angels, stand up, get up, you fell again. It happens over and over and over for him. And that's not even God. And here's Elijah who says, as the Lord God lives, before whom I stand. That's a message. What's God got to say? What is God saying through this man? There will be neither dew nor rain these years, plural, years, except by my word. Who does this man think he is? Not that he predicts the weather, but that he controls the weather. That he would say, God, before whom I stand, has authorized me to tell you this. There will be neither rain nor dew, no moisture, no moisture. Except on Mondays and Thursdays when you can water your lawn. No moisture. Until this drought ends, the natural seasons will bring the rains and then it'll be okay. No, not that. Not that. This is going to happen until I say rain. And then he's gone. I mean, he's gone. That's it. He comes in, makes that statement, and he leaves. And Ahab and all his entourage are standing there dumbfounded. Who was that masked man? Where'd that guy come from? We don't even know him. And who does he think he is to offer that? Now, what you need to know is that for the rest of chapter 17, that drought happens. For how long? 3.5 years. 3.5 years. You and I cannot come close to understanding the effects of that. You know what it's like around here. We don't get rain for a couple of months. Just a couple of months. We don't get rain. Everybody's screaming. I live near the Hillsborough River. And from our house, when we drive off, Paula says to me all the time, when we're in that season just before the rains start that we're getting now, just before that, Paula says, here we go again. It's your usual speech. I have never seen the river so low. I think I could walk across it. I believe I could cross the Hillsborough River and not be in over my head. And Paula says, you say that every year. Well, every year we have that difficulty. But then what happens? We don't really think that's going to be permanent. It's going to get better, isn't it? It's going to get better because we're going to have rains. Now, I want you to imagine there are no rains this year. Now, how's that river look? And next year, during that early spring season when we're not getting rains, what's that river look like now? And how does that affect people? I'll tell you what. You go 1 year, you go 2 years like that, I'm telling you, you got people dying. You got people dying. And all the assumptions we make about water are gone. And then you start thinking about the guy who's responsible for that. And Ahab puts out a bounty. I want that man. If he says there's no rain until he speaks, he's going to speak. I'm going to wrangle it out of him. You find that man. And for 3.5 years, Elijah's on the lam. He's gone. And I know, I don't want to get too much into this part of the story, but we paint that picture of Elijah there by the brook, and the birds are coming in and feeding him. And I don't know about you, but we probably have made that so pristine and sanitary that it sounds like a nice scene, like big birds bringing in packaged meals for him, you know. No meals on wheels, it's meals on wings here. You know, and they bring them in and it's already set and it's all that. Hey, I didn't get my honey mustard. We'll be back. You know, and we may tend to think of it that way. It was nothing like that. The birds that bring him the food, they're carrion eaters. The ravens are carrion eaters. They're not bringing him prepared meals. They're bringing him whatever they can pick up, whatever they're able to carry. It's not meals ready to eat by human standards, but by carrion birds it is. And then you think about, oh, it's a brook Cherith, you know, it's that nice, he goes down there and he picks up a cup and it's sparkling clear water and he drinks it. And you need to remember that that brook is running dry. Now what does the water look like? You know, after a while you're sucking mud. Elijah doesn't have it a whole lot better than the people in his country until God sends him away. And then we come to chapter 18. And that is where Elijah offers his challenge. 3.5 years later, he commands Ahab, "You bring it on. Come on out. It's time for the big test." Dusts off his hands. We're ready to go. It's me against your best prophet. No. It's me against 10 of your best prophets. No, it's not that. Who is it? Ahab, bring on 450 prophets of Baal. And, as their seconds, 400 prophets of Asherah. Now, just for a moment, picture that contest as a theological debate. And Elijah shows up and there's a table on this side of the platform, and there's a table with one chair. And on the other side is seating for more people than will fit in this auditorium. Full. 850 prophets. And Elijah looks at it and says, "I think we're ready." And he sets the terms of the contest. "We'll each build an altar, put a sacrifice on top of it, call on our God, and the God who answers by fire, he's a real God. Deal?" And the 850 say, "Deal." And Elijah says, not flip a coin, we'll see who goes first. He says, "You go first. You go first." And so the 450 prophets of Baal limber up and get ready for the contest. And the 400 prophets of Asherah get out the pom-poms and get ready to cheer on the prophets of Baal. And you know how that story goes. We're not going to take a lot of time to talk about that. But I want you to think about something before we get further into the story. I want you to think about one man standing alone against an entire nation, because he has nobody on his side, not that he knows of. And this is a nation and a gathering of people who in all likelihood are all touched in tragic ways by what Elijah promised. Do you think about that? There's nobody up there on that mountain that does not hold him accountable for terrible tragedies that have occurred in their lives. How do you feel about Elijah? If you're a mother who's lost a child because of severe dehydration, how do you feel about Elijah if all your crops have failed for the third year in a row because of this man? How do you feel about Elijah if you yourself have suffered terribly at his hands? You see, no one was spared that drought. If God causes the rain to fall on the fields of the just and the unjust, in this case, God withheld the rain from the fields of the just and the unjust. Nobody was exempt. I pointed out to you, not even Elijah was totally exempt from the effects of this drought. And remember that it has been going on 3.5 years. So when Elijah stands up on Mount Carmel to begin this contest, I think the feelings of bitterness and hatred toward him were palpable. He had to feel the baleful glares of that audience as they looked on for the first time. They looked on the man who has caused them such horror. And I'll tell you what's amazing. What is amazing is that Elijah commanded such respect from that group, such awe surrounded him, that they did not tear him limb from limb. That they did not go up there to him and grab him and accuse him and spit in his face if they could even gather enough spittle to spit. That they did not rip his life from his body. That no one lifted a hand against Elijah. That's amazing. 3.5 years, his words, or lack thereof, have determined the course of their lives. And what success? I mean, this is not even a close match. This is like a knockout in the first round. You see the prophets of Baal limbering up and they're getting ready, and then they go into all their shenanigans and gyrations and all their calling on their God. And Elijah, meanwhile, is just feeding them. Hey guys, you know, God's going on vacation too. It's that time of year. Maybe you need to yell louder. He can't hear you. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe you need to wake him up. Maybe he's distracted and you need to get his attention. I'll bet if you guys could get his attention, we can get his attention, we'll show him we'll wound ourselves. They slash themselves, cut themselves, mutilate their bodies. And then at the end of all of this screaming and crying and cutting and bleeding and dying that they're suffering, when all that's done and they are laying around that altar in heaps of bodies, heaving for breath and life, Elijah says, "My turn." And as if it wasn't already weighted enough against him, he fixes this fight against himself. Bring water. I've often wondered, where did they get that much water? And what a cruel thing to do. What a cruel thing to do, to bring water and just pour it out on the ground. Soak the altar. Soak the sacrifice. Drench it. Drench it. Drench it again. Dredge out a trench around it so it holds water. And then when it's all done and there is no way of light, you know, I love grilling out, but one of the great problems I have is even with those briquettes that say Everlight, they don't always. And you can pour all kinds of lighter fluid on top of it and light it, and it looks good for a moment and it goes right out. for Elijah to do this and soak the wood, soak the sacrifice, soak the altar, and then say to God, fire it up. And God does. I mean, he does. He does it in a big way. Says he lit the sacrifice, licked up all the water in the trench, just one big hit. I'm inclined to think, just my personal thinking, I'm inclined to think what we saw is a massive lightning strike. It just fired that whole area up. Well, we know who wins the contest, but it's not over yet because Elijah says, seize those prophets. I don't think it took much to seize them. They weren't going anywhere. They're bleeding and weak, tired, demoralized. And then the text tells us something. It says in verse 40 of chapter 18, do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. I want you to remember that. Elijah killed the prophets of Baal. And then he goes up higher on the mountain, and there's that great scene of him petitioning God, puts his head between his knees, prays to God, now it's time, Lord. And he sends his servant out there. What do you see? Go look toward the Mediterranean. What do you see? I don't see anything. Come back. Keep praying. What do you see? I don't see anything. Come back. What do you see? I don't see anything. 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 I think if I'm the servant, by now I'm saying, are you listening? I told you I don't see anything. It's no different this time than it was last time you asked. It's the exact same report. There's nothing out there. And Elijah says, go again. And he comes back. And I don't know if he came back with this, okay, there's one, listen to me, one little cloud the size of my fist. That's how big, in the whole sky, there's one little cloud. Or if he came back and he said, ho, it's working. It's working. We got a cloud. We got a cloud sighting out there. And then what's amazing about this whole thing is the way Elijah responds. He says, go tell Ahab, storm coming. Do you ever think that? Do you ever see one little cloud in the sky and say, oh, put the top up on the convertible. It's going to rain. One little cloud. And Elijah is convinced this is it. This is it. Go tell Ahab, torrential rains are coming. And that's exactly what happens. Now, is that a successful day? I can't imagine that Elijah went to bed that night saying, I think there's a little more we could have done today. I mean, that is one successful venture. Prophets of Baal, dead. His God, vindicated. Rain, torrential rains. Ahab is soaked on the way. And Elijah outruns Ahab's chariot to Jezreel. Outruns a chariot. The next morning, chapter 19. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. How he had killed all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. I want you to hear the sinister words of this messenger. He finds Elijah, and I can just see him almost whispering in his ear these words. So may the gods, plural, gods, do to me. And even more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of those prophets by tomorrow this time. In other words, Elijah, enjoy your last 24 hours of life. I am making it my life's work to make you just like the prophets you killed. And if it doesn't happen, may the gods inflict me. She's made this a life and death struggle with Elijah. Now, given what Elijah did yesterday, would you worry about that message? Would you not send a message back? Hey, take this back to her. You're on, Jezebel. You're on. I'll make you like your prophets. You can join them in their graves because I and my God have the power. But he doesn't. That's not how he reacts. In fact, he flees. Verse 3 is shocking to us. And he was afraid, and he arose, and he ran for his life. And then he leaves his servant there. His servant can't keep up with him. He leaves him there. He goes a day's journey into the wilderness, and there he comes to where we opened our lesson. He sat down under a juniper tree and requested that he might die. He says, "Lord, kill me." Now, he knows, unlike we who think we can make those kinds of statements and not suffer the consequences. So we say things like, "Eat liver? I'd rather die." But none of us thinks, okay, God's going to say, "You're dead." Nobody thinks that. But Elijah's dealing with a God who has done that. For 3.5 years has taken the life of his people, who through him killed 450 prophets of Baal and maybe the 400 prophets of Asherah. "Kill me, God, just kill me. I don't want to live." James chapter 5, verse 17 says that Elijah, in the Living Letters translation, says, and this is why I like this phrase, says of Elijah, he was a man, listen to this, a man as perfectly human as we are. I love that phrase because it seems like a contradictory statement. We are anything but perfect. But the point it's being made here is he is totally human like we are. And that's the point James is making. James is making the point that Elijah is one of us. He's like us. Now, you say, "Ralph, there isn't anything in this story up to this point that sounds like me. I've never had that kind of contest. I've never had that kind of courage. I've never stood up to that many people. I've never had that kind of success in my conflicts with God. That has not happened to me." But this part has. If I ask for a show of hands, "Have you ever been fearful?" we'd raise our hands. "Have you ever run for your life?" We may have physically, we may have mentally, we may have emotionally. This is the Elijah who is like us. So how does this happen? The pits. He's up on the pinnacle, chapter 18. Chapter 19, he is in the pits. I mean, if you ask Elijah, "How's today going?" listen how bad it is. "I want to die. In fact, I just don't want to die. I'm begging God to kill me." How bad is that? "I want to die. And I've asked God to take my life." And so he flees. Let me give you some quick observations as to why I think it is that Elijah might have gotten to this point. And there are things that can happen to any of us. First of all, he is suffering from a substantial and sustained effort. What he did yesterday that we've described in detail is significant. I got to tell you, in some ways, Elijah is like Samson. Because the text tells us he built that altar. He dug those trenches. He stacked the rocks for the altar. He slaughtered that bull. A bull, not a little lamb. He slaughtered a bull and he prepared it for sacrifice. And after this was all over, he killed 450, possibly 850 people. Now look, I'm not trying to be gruesome here, but if you go past that without stopping to think about what kind of energy it would take to take the lives of 850, even 450 people, can you imagine what that takes? I mean, let's just for the moment assume he's got the sharpest axe in the world and it only takes one chop per head. You're still whacking 450 heads off. That's no small thing. And he did that after all the other things that I've talked about. And then he climbs up to the top of the summit. After he does that, goes all the way up to the top, and then he outran a chariot. Do you know how far? He outran a chariot 15 miles to Jezreel. There is a toll that this kind of physical exhaustion takes, not just on the body, but on the mind. From Carmel to the juniper tree may be a long distance, but it's really a pretty short interval. It doesn't take long to get to one from the other. And in our lives, I don't know if this is true for you, but I find the higher the mountain, the deeper the valleys. And the higher we go, the farther we can fall. And Elijah's been to the mountaintop, and he is now in the pits. Peter, in an act of bravery, hacks off Malchus's ear, and then immediately denies he knows who Jesus is. In the presence of those soldiers, he strikes out bravely. And then in the presence of a serving maid, says, "I do not know the man." Secondly, he is suffering from a realization that the conflict with evil is never ending. You know, just yesterday he killed 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah are gone. And today, evil raises its head again. It's a never-ending battle. I remember when we lived in Concord, North Carolina. We were in a dry city, in a dry county. Couldn't serve alcohol in the whole county. Thought that was bliss. That was wonderful. And then the pro-alcohol forces came. And it came to a vote, and we beat it. And everybody rejoiced. And 2 years later, it came to a vote again, and we beat it. And everybody said, "Well, it's good, but it's getting closer." And it came up a third time and a fourth time. And do you know what Concord and Cabarrus County is today? It's a wet county. And that can be discouraging. You beat it down and beat it down, and it keeps coming back. And here's Elijah thinking, "We beat it. We beat the false prophets," and they're back. He just couldn't see much being accomplished in his work, because he didn't see with God's eyes. In chapter 19 and verse 10, he says, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. I've torn down your altars, killed your prophets against those who have forsaken the covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets." And he says, "I alone am left." He feels like the apostles cowering in the upper room. There is no relief. Third, he's suffering from his own inadequacies. He says in chapter 19, verse 4, "It is enough, O Lord, take my life. I'm not better than my fathers." Well, whoever told him he was? Whoever told him he was better than his fathers? Maybe he's not. Maybe he's suffering from feelings of inadequacy. He is a man who needs to understand that what he is only by the power of God. And fourth, he is suffering from disillusionment with God's people. He says in verse 10, I alone am left. Has he forgotten? You know, when we are depressed and when we're down, we see things differently than they really are. And he does. Has he forgotten this man, Obadiah, who has hidden 100 prophets of God? Whoa, wait a minute, Elijah, you're not alone. There's 100 prophets out there. And God will come back and say, what? I got 7,000 people who've not bowed the knee to Baal. You are not alone here, Elijah. Never think that. Depression paints every picture with black. It's the only color it knows. And we have to be careful about making judgments like that. So, let me tell you what God does for him. Here's God's prescription for healing. First, rest, food, and a change of scenery. You can't beat that. Chapter 19, verse 3, an angel comes and feeds him a hot meal, and he goes on the strength of that food a day, and then he feeds him again, and then he comes to where? He comes to the mountain of the Lord. He has a change of scenery. He had slunk into the desert, sleepless and fatigued, went 200 miles further to Mount Horeb, and there he comes to the mountain of God. Secondly, God shows Elijah he is different than Elijah perceives him to be. I don't have time to go into detail about this, but I love this. Elijah comes out at the edge of this cave, and he's waiting for God to make his appearance. And there's a firestorm comes below him through the valley. And it says, God's not in the firestorm. And an earthquake comes. It says, God's not in the earthquake. And a violent wind like a tornado comes. God's not in the tornado. All these great bombastic powers of nature displayed before Elijah. And he thinks, oh, that's God. That's God. And it's not. And then it says a very gentle breeze began to blow in his face. Just one of those mountain breezes. Just and God says, Elijah, what are you doing here? Sometimes we think God is different than God is. Sometimes we're looking for God to make big scenes and do great things. And sometimes God appears in the small, still voice as he did to Elijah. Now, John sees an exactly different God in the book of Revelation. He sees that God that knocks you dead with his appearance. But Elijah had misunderstood what God would do. Let me tell you what I mean by that real quickly. We pray for God to do things. God, heal this person. God, make this better. God, do this. God, control these circumstances. And when he doesn't, we get depressed. And we think, maybe God's not working. Maybe God's not there. Maybe God doesn't hear. And I'm telling you, God's always there, and he always hears, but he always does what's right. And it's not by our timetable. And it's not by our conclusions. It is by his own. And finally, God gave Elijah some assignments. There's work to do, verses 15 through 18. I want you to get up and get about your work. When you're depressed, the hardest thing to do is get up and work. And the only real solution is get up and work. Do something. Not think something, not hope something, do something. And God says, I got some people I want you to anoint. I want you to anoint your successor. I want you to anoint a new king in Israel. And I want you to anoint another king in a foreign country. Get up and do it. And you're not alone. You're never alone. I got 7,000 people who are there to help you. Well, I want you to think about those things for a few moments. And we'll come back together again in just a minute.